The first time I heard about Holocaust denial, I laughed. Holocaust denial? The Holocaust, which has the dubious distinction of being the best documented genocide in the world. Who could believe it didn't happen? Many of us have been taught to think there are facts and there are opinions. After studying deniers, I think differently. There are facts, there are opinions, and there are lies. And what deniers want to do is take their lies, dress them up as opinions, maybe edgy opinions, maybe sort of out-of-the-box opinions, but then if they're opinions, they should be part of the conversation. And then they encroach on the facts.
For the avoidance of any doubt, as someone whose formative experiences were in studying modern German history and then in contemporary Central Europe, the memory of the Holocaust is a defining experience of my own life and my own view of the world. In some sense, I think that everything we've been trying to do in Europe since 1945, in a broader sense, everything we've been trying to do in building a liberal international order, is an answer to the memory of the Holocaust, and of course, it is that never again. But I am profoundly convinced that imposing bans on Holocaust denial by law is not only ineffective, but counterproductive.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money, and the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay, they are talented people and they have power, money and media and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Monica Schaefer on the show. Monica, how are you doing?
Doing just great. Thanks so much for having me on your program.
Thanks for coming on the show. Some people may know your name who are involved in the issue of Holocaust revisionism. You have your own experience. Why don't you tell our audience a little about yourself?
Okay. I grew up in Canada and my parents came from Germany. I'll just give you a very snapshot version of my story with regards to having become a political prisoner, something I just always thought was very, very far away and very evil countries, you know, bad dictatorships far away. Like when I was younger, you know, I'd heard about political prisoners, and lo and behold, I found myself becoming a political prisoner myself in a very modern Western country, namely Germany. That was in 2018, that I spent 10 months in a high security prison in Germany. So how did all that happen? Do you want me to just give you a basic
Did you rob history? A bank?
Yeah, exactly. I did something really, really bad.
Did you kidnap a member of parliament or something? You know, like Bader Meinhof or something?
You know? I mean, that's what you would think, isn't it? You know, that maybe I beat somebody up or, you know, went around with an axe and became a maniac and or did some very bad things like that. No, this was for words that are forbidden, speaking words that are forbidden. And my brother Alfred also spent time in prison, like 4 years in prison for
4 years.
For words, exactly, because he made videos, educational videos, and these go out on the World Wide Web, and that's, you know, available to people to see. But people don't have to watch these things if they don't like them. That's kind of one thing that is important to point out. Like, they say that we incite hatred or something like that, but in fact, what is happening is that, you know, if we speak truth about something that's going on in the world, and there are certain people that don't like that truth being spoken about and their lies being exposed and their lies and crimes being exposed, then they project onto us that which they do to us. So they hate the fact that we speak truth, but they call us haters and inciters of hatred, and that perhaps will cause the very thing that they are accusing us of doing will cause that to happen. So in other words, okay, what's the big taboo subject that I spoke about? The most taboo subject that is the one piece of history that you are not permitted to question or to go against the, you know, officially sanctioned orthodox version of, that would be World War II, the Holocaust. That's what we are not allowed to talk about. And you might notice that every year there are more Holocaust museums going up in various cities around the world, where you would think that these places have nothing to do with the alleged Holocaust that the Jewish people accused Germans of having done to them. So anyway, you're not allowed to talk about that. We did talk about it, and both of us, my brother and I, went to jail for it in Germany. I'll pause and let you interject, and then I can go into more detail about it. I'll let you, you know, guide me in how much detail to go into here, Timothy.
Sure. Now, it's interesting to point out that these laws weren't really put on the books until I think the last decade of the 20th century, the 1990s.
Correct.
I think as of now, there are 16 European countries, along with Canada,
yes,
and Israel, of course, that have laws against Holocaust denial. France, I think it was the Gayssot Act.
Yeah.
Passed in July 1990.
Specifically because of Robert Faurisson, a professor who did meticulous research and work for decades about the Holocaust. So they made this law specifically for him, or against him, you could say, is more accurate.
And he actually wasn't he also physically set up when he was beat up in a park?
He was assaulted and beat up numerous times, a couple of times within inches of his life. One of those times stands out in my head because I guess a passerby, a jogger, found Faurisson bloodied and beaten, laying on the ground, and this fellow called for help immediately, you know, called for 911, called for ambulance. And when the next day he learned of the identity of this person that he had rescued, he publicly stated that he regretted having done so, having, you know, rescued this elderly professor.
Because he's an elderly man he finds beaten up in a park.
Yeah.
Presumably beaten up by several younger men.
Yes.
And he regrets calling for help just because this elderly man holds a certain view on a historical narrative or issue of question of history.
Yes, that is how
that's some serious mind control.
That is serious mind control. That's a perfect way to put it.
Also to feel you're compelled to express that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He regretted it. So he needed to say that out loud, that he regretted having saved this guy. He would have rather just let him die. So I wonder what tribe he belongs to. I don't know.
Yeah. In Germany, the country where you ran afoul of the law, I think it's called the incitement of the people. This was passed again. I guess the 1990s as well. It's interesting these laws had to be passed later on. I guess as sort of revisionism and doubt started to take root with the spread of information, they felt they had to pass explicit laws to shut people up. This, I guess, coincides also with the construction of various Holocaust museums. Here in the United States, we have the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which I've gone to it's like 24 years ago, I went to pay a visit to it. And even then at the time, my point in that issue wasn't quite as well developed as today. I was pointing out inconsistencies with my date. Yeah, I went with my now wife to the Holocaust Museum.
Oh, great.
And I was, you know,
sounds like a romantic date.
Yeah, we joke about that. But in Washington, D.C., there's tons of museums. You go visit them. And this is one you have to pay for, actually. So,
yeah, they make a lot of money off of us for lying to us. Isn't that the absurd irony of it?
And apparently, to become a member of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, you've probably heard a lot about them in the recent news. I don't know how much attention you pay to American politics. A very corrupt organization, of course, always has been, but now it's become much more overtly political and leftist in a way. But, you know, they work hand in glove with the ADL and used to be with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is also a Jewish outfit. But in order to become an FBI agent, you have to go visit the Holocaust Museum.
Oh, boy, isn't that a nice prerequisite for a job? Actually, funny about these museums, I just have to tell you this. So many times people who are, you know, normies, let's just call them people who have not yet looked into these things and opened their eyes or their minds to considering that, you know, there's another version here of history. Anyway, they would say to me, have you ever been to one of these museums, Monica? And when I answered no, they say, well, you don't know anything. Like, I mean, they somehow think that these man-made museums that people decide what to put in their displays, but somehow these museums prove the Holocaust. And no agenda, right? No. And there was one Jewish girl in Jasper, and she called herself a Jewish girl, so she didn't try to hide her Jewishness. She specifically talked about those shoes. Did you ever see those shoes? Like, I went there, I saw the shoes. And I'm just thinking, well, what do shoes prove? Piles of shoes. What does that prove?
That's true. I have a pile of shoes upstairs in my room. It doesn't prove anything. So.
And, you know, in fact, what I learned sometime later is that German people were asked to donate shoes to these camps. So maybe these shoes were actually donated by the German people. Who knows? I don't know. But shoes don't prove a genocide, especially a genocide in gas chambers, nor do piles of hair. Now, they would talk about piles of hair. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what people are not told when they go on a tour there is that, okay, the reason that prisoners were shaved when they got there is because lice were a big, big problem, and lice were actually carrying a deadly disease, typhus. Mm-hmm. And yes, they did find Zyklon B canisters at Auschwitz, but these canisters of Zyklon B, that's an insecticide, and they did have gas chambers, but guess what? These gas chambers were fumigation chambers for clothing, and they were high tech. They had very, you know, good sealed doors, and then a system to evacuate the air, the gases after the clothing was put into these fumigation chambers to get rid of the lice in people's clothing and give them clean clothing, give them clothing that didn't have lice in it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were actually trying to keep the people alive. So all this evidence that is then used to prove, quote, you know, prove in quotation marks, the Holocaust, is actually evidence or, you know, physical things that were actually there to keep the people healthy. So when I say these gas chambers, like, these are just small fumigation chambers. This is not the shower rooms that they tell us that were these gas chambers that had these wooden doors and, you know, windows and all the stuff that they try to pass over.
Oh yeah, on... even the piles of shoes are fake because they're put on a ramp.
Oh wow!
So
there
it's not it's not a full pile of shoes. It's all. And yeah. Also, they have if you go to the Holocaust Museum, they have a very elaborate like diorama or model of how the process of the showers, you know, the gas chambers to the crematoriums, how it all functioned. Of course, this is just a dramatization or creation. Nothing of the like ever existed, actually. But they have a very elaborate model. Of course, these things, just like movies and you know, television shows, and you know, the Holocaust is factored into probably literally thousands of movies that have been made and TV shows.
Oh yes, and so every year more. This is not stopped.
And people, and you can't. I mean, after all, Schindler's List wasn't black and white, so it had to be a documentary. So it's true. And so, so people's understanding of these things is seen through these things, you know.
Yes.
And not to mention just the standard historical accounts. And you say the importance of a museum. The average, you know, man on the street will think he'll waltz into a museum and think he's getting a accurate standard account of history and their nation's history and culture. But as we all know, these things change over time. They can take a particularly political agenda, you know, to conform with contemporary issues, whether it's, you know, today's, you know, sort of wokeism, as they call it, or critical race theory, something like the Holocaust Museum is obviously going to have an agenda. But even the American History Art Museum is going to have this. So whenever you walk in a museum, you have to discount the fact that someone's paying for this huge structure for a reason.
You know? Yes. Yes, that's right. I look at museum displays quite differently now as I did when I was younger, and would visit museums when I traveled, or just, you know, really appreciate museums. But I mean, I suppose there's probably some kinds of museums that are really good, but these Holocaust museums, yeah, that's another story. And like you say, they come up, this story gets repeated over and over in movies. And you know what I've noticed, that even programs, whether it's a radio program, like on mainstream radio or TV shows or movies, even if these things are about completely different subjects that would have nothing to do with history, they still find a way to insert something either about Hitler or about the Holocaust, or they will just find a way, even if it's just something in passing that takes 30 seconds, but something was mentioned about, you know, making reference to, of course, those evil Nazis or evil Hitler and the Holocaust. I just find it astounding. And most people won't even notice that, because these things are just, they go by in passing. But I notice it. And you probably notice it too, because we've been tuned in to the truth. And so we'll notice these things when they come. Have you noticed that yourself?
Well, yeah, in movies. I mean, I'm probably was less attuned to it than you were, because you have this closer attachment to your topic. Or because you're ethnic German, living in Canada, of course, but you visited there a lot. You're a musician, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes.
And I understand when you start talking about this, people stop wanting to listen to you play music too, right?
Okay. So, yeah. Well,
but back to your question. I'll let you talk about that. But yeah, I mean, obviously this is something that's developed over the years. I'm your typical American. I'm Irish and German. But my German roots go back to the middle of the 18th century. Same with my Irish. I was part of that diaspora out of Ireland and Germany in the 19th century into America. As far as my interest goes, and it stemmed from just an interest in history. In fact, my interest in history was largely created by the World War II and Hitler, of course. Obviously, it was very vivid, the photographs, the films, and that's why one of the reasons why it's talked about so much is so much film. And also, whatever you have to say about the National Socialists, the Nazis, they had a certain idea for style, right? And their uniforms, their imagery, even the swastika, the flag is stunning in its own way. Obviously, it's attributed to something that's evil because of the historical accounts and the war and everything, the wartime propaganda. But as a child, as a young man, it attracted my interest because there's such a very interesting topic, and it got more interesting the more I found out about it.
That's interesting. I'm always interested in people's awakening stories. Yeah. I mean, you were very interested as a child in these symbols and in this history, but when did you actually realize that there's something wrong with the official narrative? Like, did you instinctively know that?
First, it's sort of my understanding of the Second World War and my problems with war in general.
Yeah.
And I knew that the Second World War is being constantly used as an excuse for U.S. intervention and belligerency everywhere, whether it's Saddam Hussein's new, everyone was a new Hitler, right?
Yes.
Everyone's new Hitler. And so every time you start, if you're speaking about a military operation like the Gulf War in 1991 or 2003, people would say, what would you do? What would you do in 1941? What would you do in 1940? Would you let Hitler take over the world? Then I said, the more I learned about that, about Hitler's objectives in the Second World War, even for the standard narrative count, serious historians never argue that Hitler wanted to take over the world and that the history didn't begin in 1941. It didn't begin in 1938. If you want to go back to the roots of the Second World War, you have to go back to Versailles. Mm-hmm. Or you have to go back to the trenches and the outbreak of the First World War. After all, we call it the Second World War because it was the First World War and the consequences of the peace. So even without becoming a revisionist, you learned about the very complex history that you can't use the military situation in 1941 as a pretext or excuse for constant belligerency, which was being done by, right wingers in America, these things. My politics have always been conservative. So that's where I related to was more the right wing part of the country. Yeah. So there was that. But then as you look more into it, I came across certain literature, PDFs like Earl Butz's book, The Hoax of the 20th Century.
Arthur Butz,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I couldn't refute what he was saying in there. And I looked around for people who were actually refuting it. And I couldn't find any substantive refutation of the points. Then I ran into some of the other historical, like David Irving and some of these other, and I said, wait, they're not refuting this person. They're condemning them. They're destroying their lives or beating them.
Oh, there you
apart,
go.
You know,
yeah.
And there,
you hit the nail. Yeah.
Yeah.
You hit
and
the
then
nail on the head.
when you ran, there really is no evidence for some of the stupendous. And also the fact that the narrative was constantly changing. When I grew up, it was lampshades, bars of soap, shrunken heads. These things. Then you turned out, wait, that never happened. Then you turn out, it was a time they claimed there were as many as 24 death camps all throughout Europe, strewn throughout Europe. Oh, no, there are only three or four in the East. The Western camps weren't. Then it wasn't 4 million died at Auschwitz. It was 900,000. So how do you subtract 4 million from it and still get 6 million? Then you start getting a number that's so low that could be explained by the conditions of war itself, whether it's the typhus outbreak in the camps, the destruction of the German economy, and of course that's going to lead to starvation and terrible conditions all throughout the country, especially in the camps. And that's where you go, wait a second, none of this makes, this is a much more plausible explanation to what occurred. Then you start to come realize how that narrative supports the current regime, if you will, the current power structure of the world that's constantly used, not only for a pretext for constant or excuse for constant U.S. military intervention, but also it's used for the effectively Jewish takeover of American foreign policy, if not.
Yeah, that's the key right there. Boy, did you ever do a fantastic summation of this whole history and the narrative and what's wrong with the narrative just in a very short few minutes. Yeah. And really at the end there, that's where it is, that it's about Jewish power. The Holocaust narrative, like sometimes people would say to me, Monica, why do you concern yourself with something that happened so long ago? Because, even, let's say, caring individuals who could see what was going on in Jasper, in my hometown of 37 years, I lived there. and they could see that the whole town was kind of ganging up on me. And some, you know, acquaintances, they would say, Monica, why are you bringing this on yourself? Like, this is not relevant anymore. We have to deal with current issues. There's much more important things we could be talking about that are happening right now. And I just would shake my head and say, well, isn't that funny? If this was irrelevant to our today's day and age, then they wouldn't care what I said about it, would they now? But it's extremely relevant. And you see, the Holocaust, I think, is like the linchpin lie. And when that collapses, and it is collapsing under its own weight of lies, then the people will connect the dots. Like, we have to help connect the dots for the people about Jewish power. That's what this is about. Because if this Holocaust narrative is false, which it demonstrably is, then we come to understand that this age-old story that the Jews are the persecuted people and we are persecuting them, and that, you know, somehow we are just innately anti-Semitic, whatever that word is, it's a misnomer anyway, but regardless, this is their age-old story forever. They've said, oh, we're always persecuted, you know, they're chased out of Egypt and then they're chased out of here, chased out of there, and you know, the poor Jews, they're persecuted people, when in fact they are the villain all through history. I mean, why they got chased out of places was because they were destroying those places where they were the parasite, where they, you know, basically are sucking the host dry. I mean, they have been kicked out and kicked out and kicked out. And then this Holocaust narrative for them, I mean, as what's the name of that rabbi that said, oh, it's a very successful historical fiction. I don't remember the name of the rabbi that said that very clearly. It's a successful historical fiction. So successful for whom? It's successful for them, the Jews, because they have immense power. So at the same time that they say they have been persecuted and, you know, that the evil, evil Germans killed 6 million of them in and made lampshades and soap and shrunken heads out of them and whatnot. And so they are crying that they are the persecuted people while they are the ones who wield the sword and have the power. And they have, you know, they do it by deception. And now, you know, what has the Holocaust lie led to? It led directly to them being able to get away with the 9/11 false flag operation. And, you know, the perpetrator still at large, and the fact that nobody can talk openly about it in governments or police agencies means the perpetrators are still at large. And it was, you know, the organized Jewry, Israel, and their tentacles in the United States who did that. And then now the current genocide that is being perpetrated against us with this COVID, the jab, you know, this jab, the so-called vaccine, a bioweapon. How did they get to do that? If they had not gotten away with the Holocaust lie, they would never have been able to do this. And this is the biggest of all, because they are trying very hard, and they will succeed partially in killing very many of us. You know, so this, I think the Holocaust lie is extremely important to uncover, and it still is very relevant. If it was not relevant, they wouldn't keep building more Holocaust museums and passing legislation in ever more countries that you cannot talk about it, you cannot question it. And that, you alluded to that a few minutes ago, you know, Canada now has joined the ranks of those primitive European countries who have legislation that you're not allowed to talk about a certain subject in history.
And yes, it was apparently this was part of a budget bill that was passed last
year. It's part of a budget bill. How do you get that? How do you sneak this extremely vile piece of legislation, which is like my brother calls these just blots of toner on paper? It is completely meaningless if you think about God's law or natural law, whatever way you want to think about how we should live. And we are born free. And this, you know, who was it? Schiller said, we are born free, even if we are born in shackles. we are born free and we have God-given rights, we have God-given freedoms. Nobody should be able to just dictate to us how we live. I mean, there are natural laws, there are God-given laws that, you know, we don't go around and just slaughter our neighbor or whatever. But this is, you know, we have our natural laws. And these blots of toner on paper are completely meaningless. They're telling us that there's a certain piece of history that they're going to just determine by blots of toner on paper happened a certain way. And then if we say, well, no, that's not actually, doesn't align with the facts and evidence, and then they can forcefully stop you from that. They put you in jail or, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, it is so ludicrous. Do you know, I'll tell you something else. This kind of goes along the lines of museums proving something. What we talked about earlier, oh, well, there's a museum, so that proves that it happened. Well, here's the other ludicrous thing. After I got out of jail and I was back in Jasper and, you know, there were people who were very, very much against me there, like really a lot. And anyway, this one fellow, I was actually playing my violin on the sidewalk there and tourists were really enjoying that. And this one young fellow, pretty sure he's Jewish, he started ranting and raving in a loud voice. She's a proven Holocaust denier. And he's pointing at me, you know, and he's trying to get all these tourists riled up against me while they were enjoying the music. She's a proven Holocaust denier. They proved it. She's, you know, convicted Holocaust denier. So his logic is that, oh, just because some court in Germany found me guilty of this quote unquote crime that I, you know, broke their paragraph 130 law in Germany, that I'm a proven Holocaust denier. I just laughed, actually, and I said to him also in a loud voice so that all these people could hear, well, I'm so relieved that you do not confuse me with somebody who still believes all those lies. Thank you. That's it.
Yeah, just the question, that the emotional state or just the sense of entitlement of that man to come and interrupt you when you're engaged in something completely non-political, you're playing music.
Exactly.
You know, it shows that sort of the a totalitarian mindset that they have. Again, projection here, right?
Yes.
Projection. In Canada, it's that's what the law reads. Criminal Code S-319. Henceforth, mm-hmm. Everyone who, by communicating statements other than in private conversation, willfully promotes anti-Semitism by condoning or denying or downplaying the Holocaust is guilty of an indictable offense and liable to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 2 years, or is guilty of an offense punishable on summary conviction. I understand there's a part of that that says if you believe what you're saying is true, you may not be convicted, which is kind of funny. So that's not even a defense in Germany. I think truth isn't a defense.
Well, you know how they get around that in Germany? Because in Germany, the word denial, actually, each language, you know, there's nuances to the words. Uh-huh. And the word in German is leugnen, or the noun would be leugnau. And the leugnen, you cannot leugne or deny something which did not happen. And so how they get around that is they say that about Alfred or about Ursula Haverbeck or whoever they're charging, they say he or she knows that the Holocaust happened, but is lying about it and says it didn't happen. That's how they get around it. So they're reading your minds now. Like that's what they'll publicly, yeah, that's right. Jeez. They'll read your mind.
I love this. They go, first of all, promoting anti-Semitism. They never define what anti-Semitism is, of course.
No. It has to be vague.
Yeah.
It's really important that these laws are vague. And the law in Germany is even more vague. Actually, just replace the word Holocaust in that Canadian law with Nationalist Socialist Germany. See, in Germany, the paragraph 130 doesn't actually have the word Holocaust in it, but everybody knows it's the Holocaust denial law. But they talk about you cannot, what were those three things? You cannot praise or downplay or diminish or whatever the Holocaust.
Well, it's correcting the number. Say you went into evidence or suggesting that the numbers have been overblown, then you're diminishing it, even though
right. The
truth is it needs to be diminished because the numbers have been grossly exaggerated for political reasons.
And funny enough, if Jewish writers diminish the numbers, or they diminish the numbers at Auschwitz. Nobody goes to jail for that, right?
Yeah, diminishment. That's a diminishment. Yeah. The idea that downplaying or questioning the Holocaust narrative is inherently anti-Semitic, because I guess modern Jews' whole identity is based on the Holocaust. So by questioning Holocaust, yes, you're denying their identity, and I guess you in a way guilty of maybe promoting a second Holocaust.
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly right. That if you ask any Jewish person anywhere, what do they identify with their Jewishness? What is the most, you know, what are some of the things that make them Jewish? Holocaust will always come up, always. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is their identity. It's basically their religion, you could say, like Holocaustianity, that is their religion. So anybody who goes against it is a heretic, and heretics must be burned at the stake.
And that's a state religion now in most countries.
Yes, it is.
if you were to pass a law in Canada or propose a law saying questioning the Holy Trinity or the divinity of Jesus Christ, and you publicly deny that, and you're indictable, that's an indictable offense, punishable to 2 years in prison, what would be the response, you know, from civil libertarians, as they say?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's right. People would, like, that's actually a really good comparison to make for people who are not yet awake and aware about this, the Holocaust lie, is just those laws. Like, think about that, you know, people, think about that, that if you have a law that tells you you have to believe this tribe's religion, and this is their religion, and then, or else you go to jail. Yeah, compare it to just what you said. You can blaspheme Jesus Christ and nothing happens. Nothing at all.
Yeah, and I would say much of what constitutes modernity is blaspheming Jesus Christ.
Yes.
As Darius Stutzkind said, the modern world is Jewish.
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And so it becomes our state religion because our state is controlled by the Jews. And yet they still say that they are persecuted, and yet they wield all this power over us. And that's why it's so important that we talk about these things, because their power will evaporate once, you know, a certain critical mass of people understand what's going on and you know, see through the lies, because then the people will not go along with this anymore. I mean, with this what's happened in the last 3 years here with the COVID stuff and then the jab and all these people just lining up, rolling up their sleeves. Well, that wouldn't have happened if people had been aware and awake of what's going on and that there is an agenda. But see, we're very, very trusting in general. So our trusting nature has been used against us by these eternal well poisoners, the eternal enemy of mankind. They've used our good qualities and turned them against us. So our trusting nature has caused people to trust that they're doing this for our good, that we have to go get the vaccine, that we, you know, and then they gaslight us and say, oh yeah, we never said it would stop the spread. Oh, I'm laughing, but it's not funny at all. You know, it's just that they have just been gaslighting us to such a degree. It makes you, it's crazy making, I guess that's what gaslighting does.
Make it question your own sanity, your own rationality, your own critical faculties. So that's what fear does, you know.
Yes, all the that's fear right. Porn.
It's a negative faith. It's a state religion now. I don't know how religious you are, but the traditional Catholic understanding of these things, it was a time when the Catholic Church openly talked about, you know, the Jewish question. And it said in 1890, observing the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, what had happened to France in the last 100 years. And it came to the conclusion that this was in a Catholic magazine called Catholic Civilization, Civiltà Cattolica, I think that was pronounced. But it said that any country that forsakes Christ will become to be ruled by Jews. And the vacuum's created, and it's sort of a reflection of the modern world. And this is something, if you look at the in the wake of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, you had Jewish emancipation throughout the West. Prior to that, you had all these laws and restrictions for Jews in society. They were seen as an alien group.
Yes.
Of course, these are societies that were explicitly Christian, if not Catholic, integral societies. And so it understood that the state and religion were fused, and it reflected the society. And everyone, at least theoretically, abided by these rules, and this was the faith of the polis, of the society. That ended with the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars. You had the rise of secular republics, and with Jewish emancipation, Jews were able to gain full citizenship in society. And this happened in England. This happened in France. This happened in Germany, and all throughout Europe. And so throughout the 19th century, they were able to gain a certain amount of financial leverage. We're talking about powerful Jews like the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
And good example, like in England, it is said that Nathaniel Rothschild had bet on the English pound. I think he was able to take over the Bank of England based on Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo, meaning he originally he started a whispering campaign saying that Napoleon had won. And so the British pound plummeted in the wake of that news. It turns out, of course, Napoleon didn't win at Waterloo, and he was able to buy everything for a song. And from that point on, he was able to leverage that wealth to essentially take over the Bank of England, the English mint. And by the middle of the 19th century, the British Empire was pretty much a Rothschild interest.
Right.
And so you had this gaining and also you had the function of usury and interest. And the Jews were able to leverage their financial power to gain political power. In England, particularly, you had this the landed aristocracy that had come to power in the wake of the English Reformation. Henry VIII, decided to break from the Catholic Church over the divorce issue. Well, what ensued, there was a huge looting operation of church property, and you had what you call, sort of an ascendant aristocracy. And in the 19th century, they became very materialistic, and they also very greedy, and they wanted to build huge manor homes. And they went into debt to Jewish creditors to build these homes that everyone knows now in England and the English Empire and these aristocracy. And because they went into debt, Jews were able to leverage that debt to gain access, intermarriage into the British establishment. Whoa. And this factors into like the Churchill family. Churchill's father was in heavy debt. I think owned like £60,000 to Natty Rothschild. And of course, Churchill himself was in debt to Jews in the 1930s, which explained his position with Germany, the position he took with Germany. Mm-hmm. This was the group called the Focus. I don't know if you're familiar with this history.
This is really excellent. I'm glad you're refreshing me on it. Yeah. It's really, really good, and refreshing the audience on it. That's very, very good.
So the British Empire sort of became not taken over, but fused with Jewish interests. And of course, we all know about the Balfour Declaration, British designs in the Middle East regarding Palestine. Of course, that's really Rothschild. There was an account in 1870s when the British took over the Suez Canal. What was his name? The British Prime Minister. The Jewish Prime Minister.
Disraeli or something?
Disraeli, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called Königsby, which talks about pretty much it's a novel about Jewish power controlling behind the scenes. He's the one that made that quote that we are governed by personages we never know, and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But he has a meeting. I was reading what's his name? The historian, the economic historian. Anyway, that's not. I was reading an account of how the Suez Canal was purchased, and the British Parliament wasn't in session, so Disraeli meets with Rothschild, his friend,
yeah,
co-ethnic, and he says, "Will you loan me the money to buy the canal?" And Rothschild goes, "What do you have to offer by way of collateral?" And he goes, "The British state."
Oh, jeez.
So there you go. And of course, with the Balfour Declaration, you have this promise for British support for the Jewish state in return for what? Getting the United States into the war on behalf of Great Britain, because they were at the time not doing well against Germany, and the war would have ended with a with a limited German victory at that point in late 1916, because you've already had the Battle of the Somme that failed. And Germans were about to win in the East with Russia because Russia was being knocked out of the war. But the Balfour Declaration pretty much was a deal to get Jews and break Britain to leverage Jewish power in the United States to get Woodrow Wilson to declare war, to ask Congress to declare war on Germany, which he did right after he was reelected.
So in 100% Jews fomenting the war and getting more countries involved in the war, all these Jewish intrigues, 100%. Like if the majority of people understood the history that you just outlined, like this is really important stuff, like really important, this background. They didn't teach us this in grade school, did they?
No, I didn't. Again, I'm coming to this after reading multiple books and listening to multiple, scholars write about this, and a picture starts to form in my mind. And this is how the Jewish century, the 20th century became the Jewish century, leveraging financial power to gain political and cultural power.
Yes,
and that's where they obviously they exert that power greatly today. Funny, it goes back to usury.
Yes. And usury is something that I always just took for granted. Like when we were in elementary school, I think, we had some unit in social studies class where we're learning about money and, how money started and just a placeholder for value instead of just trading goods for goods, and then this interest thing, this thing called interest. And then I remember at some point, I just started being puzzled by when if somebody's in debt or countries are in debt and they're supposed to pay back more than they borrowed, and then if everybody's in debt and they're all supposed to pay back more than they borrowed, how do they ever succeed with that? It just never added up in my mind, even in my young mind, before I understood anything about the fact that, we're being, purposefully defrauded and just, controlled by all this. But I just didn't understand, how does it all add up if you have to pay back more? How can you pay back more? Mm-hmm. To me, my mathematical and logical mind did not permit me to understand it. And now I know why. I mean, we know that this usury is what is absolutely at the root of so much evil. And, then, of course, we know that the Jews now just print money out of nothing. And, if there's debt, it's just numbers on paper, but yet you're indebted, like you're basically a slave. So anyway, I just find the whole thing interesting. And the other thing they didn't teach us in school is that there, different religions have made usury against, or countries used to make usury illegal, or religions, were against usury. We didn't learn that. We just learned the current Jewish system. We weren't told that it's a Jewish system, but it was just this is the way it was, right? So I find that quite interesting that usury has been against the law in many times and places, right? Am I correct on that?
Yeah, there were a series of prohibitions against it historically. Yeah. And it kind of, again, economic necessity or convenience took hold. And also, you can also blame the concupiscence or weakness of the Christian or Goyim population. I mean, they knew they could exploit them with easy credit, but buy now, pay later type of approach, or consumerism. And you talk about Jewish influence, you talk about in terms of like advertising and like Edward Bernays and these things, how they've weaponized sex with pornography. Now I'm seeing gambling just exploding here in the United States. Sports betting has just gone off the charts. There used to be that sports betting was illegal, was done under the table. You had an office pool. Now it's like on the internet.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And all this is in the thing that this is, you're promoting this. It's a vice. It used to be that gambling was a vice. This started with Las Vegas, which of course was the Jewish mafia, was involved in that.
Right.
Meyer Lansky,
right.
His outfit. And of course that also became a convenient method for laundering, money, from the drug trade and other illegal operations,
But I didn't know that having a sports bet. Like I remember in the warden service, I used to work for Parks Canada. I was a national park warden for a while, and there used to be these little What did you call it? Like a bet
Yeah,
on.
they're off the books. No
Yeah.
one pays attention unless they get too big. But they are, they
Yeah.
used to be technically illegal. In fact, many are. I think you still you have to have a license for it, you know, that sort of thing. But now, I mean, the last time only place you could gamble in the United States was Las Vegas, and you have to go to Cuba, like before Castro
Right.
kicked the mob out. Then they it spread to Atlantic City. Now every state has a casino, and usually it's the states. It's like the Rust Belt, you know, whereas in you go to Pittsburgh, you used to have, you know, a steel plant. Now they have a casino.
Yeah, and these things are big fundraiser opportunities for clubs and organizations and what that they'll go to the casino in the nearby city and work for a weekend and make lots of money for their little nice little church organization or whatever organization they have, you know, sports team, and it's all promoted.
And now professional sports now, of course, professional sports have always been connected to organized crime, and at least here in the States. It's probably true up in Canada with hockey teams too. But I'm
Oh,
saying,
probably, yeah.
but if you look at the families, the big families that were behind some professional sports franchises were families tied to organized crime and illegal gambling. So it's always, and illegal gambling has always dwarfed sports revenue, which, you know, there's always been a corruption of sports because of the
Right.
gambling. And if you have revenue that exceeds gambling revenue exceeds profits of sports clubs by 10 times, I don't see how the second effect occurs on the field, you know.
Right.
You know,
Well,
so.
anyway, we've certainly this is really interesting because it's all related because we're talking about Jewish power, Jewish influences, and whatnot. We've definitely migrated from our original topic.
Well, that probably just pervades. It does. It becomes normalized. You know.
Well, for sure.
Now you talk a lot about, of course, you know, the narrative of the Second World War, the Holocaust narrative. And it's interesting to see it as a narrative because so much of the evidence of Holocaust is in literature. It's whether it's written up by eyewitness accounts or books like Elie Wiesel's Night or Diary of Anne Frank or The Painted Bird, these books that are passed on or passed to the public as accurate accounts, personal
Yeah.
accounts. But remember, it's a literary account, and that's why it's
And
important.
Elie, let's talk about Elie Wiesel. He was given the choice when the camp that he was in was liberated. He was given the choice to go with the Germans, retreat with the Germans, or to wait for the Red Army to come. And he went with the Germans. Now, am I recounting this accurately? Do you know about that? But I just think that's so interesting because he's written this book, Night, as you referenced, and you know, it was all about the Holocaust and
He never
evil
mentions
back.
gas chambers, so I guess he's a Holocaust denier.
Oh, well, isn't that interesting? But he does make all kinds of other lies
Well,
about it, doesn't he?
flames, right? There are huge flames that
Oh yeah,
piles of
coming out the
exhaust.
chimneys and stuff. Yeah, so Elie Wiesel, he's also the one that says every Jew should reserve a healthy corner in their heart or mind or whatever to for hatred, pure hatred against the Germans. Like, isn't it Elie Wiesel that said that? Anyway, you know, he's yeah, and he's some lauded as a Holocaust survivor, and yet I think that he was exposed as not even having the tattoo on the right, on the
Yeah, he
correct arm.
never could manifest the tattoo.
No, it wasn't on the correct arm, or it was too big or too little or something. It was just like there was a lot of fraud around that.
Well, you like someone
And
like Anne Frank, the diary, of course, was well, at least half of it was written by somebody else, a
his her
ballpoint pen.
father.
And there was a
Yeah.
lawsuit with the ghostwriter.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's
They're
a it's
fighting
a
over the money.
It's a pure fiction. It's a pure fiction. And yet we're all compelled to read that book in school. I was. Were you? Did you have to read that?
Yes, and there's also Night is also read too.
Okay. I don't remember reading Night, but I do remember we all had to read The Diary of Anne Frank. And I have it on my bookshelf and I keep it just for the historical records too, if I need to, you know,
Well,
make
she
reference.
went to Auschwitz, which supposedly was the final destination, you know, the death camp. But she died, was in Belsen of typhus
Yeah, she
or
died
Dachau?
of
Died, it was,
sickness.
so she died of that typhus, which everyone talks about because of the conditions in the camp. strenuous efforts were made to fight the typhus outbreak. That's on record.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a guy named Edward Wirth in Auschwitz. They called him the Angel of Auschwitz, where he was an SS doctor who was called the Angel of Auschwitz by the inmates of the camp because of his strenuous efforts made to save the lives.
Oh, there you go.
And the SS spent, I think, equivalent of $1 billion or marks to save lives at Auschwitz to stem the pandemic, which again conflicts with the narrative. And you read this, you're like, wait a second, this doesn't make sense with the standard narrative if they're dedicated to murder.
Preserving. No, and babies are born there. Thousands of babies were born in Auschwitz. There were weddings, there were brothels, there were all kinds of things going on there, theater and whatnot, that doesn't match up with death camp, right? But what about this, you know, the second most vilified name is, next to Adolf Hitler, is, I would say, Dr. Mengele, you know, in terms of, or the most recognizable, like anything that happens, oh, that's like Dr. Mengele, or everybody seems to have met Dr. Mengele. Every Jew has met Dr. Mengele. And I thought, wow, he must have had many, many clones, because every Holocaust survivor has some story about what Dr. Mengele did.
Well, it's a reference. These characters, these figures, these characters that are created by the narrative are reference points that we use. Like if Dr. Fauci, if you're condemning Dr. Fauci and his promoting the experimental mRNA drug, people often were comparing him to Dr. Mengele, right?
Yeah, that's right. So these are false comparisons, and it has really, you know, I am very, very irritated by that, that so many people who have done good work in exposing the COVID lie and the, you know, the horrors of these experimental vaccines, so-called vaccines, these injections, I should just call them, bioweapons, then they turn around and say, oh, this is as bad as the Nazis, or oh, this is like, and I always try to point out to them, and I have tried to reach out to some of these people and to say, look, why don't you make a comparison with the Bolsheviks rather than make comparison with the Nazis, because, or the National Socialists, but they call them Nazis, right? But I say, look, you're just reinforcing previous lies. So you got to understand, if we're being lied to now, they didn't just invent lying now. They've lied to us about our history, and you're reinforcing those previous lies. You're reinforcing the past lies. And in fact, the National Socialists, Adolf Hitler, and the German soldiers, they, and the many other soldiers who joined the German soldiers, by the way, it was a very, very multi-ethnic army. They were fighting the very thing that, you know, the communism, they're fighting the Reds, they were fighting the Jews, actually, and because the Bolsheviks, that's very, very Jewish, and the Red Army that was run by Jews, I mean, it was white Christian Russians who were dying on the field, but again, they were just the pawns, just like our people are the pawns going to war in these brother wars, fighting each other and killing each other for the Jews. So if people would understand that, you know, these false comparisons, that really irritates me, because they're just amplifying previous lies by making these comparisons with Fauci to Mengele. And Dr. Mengele was a good man. And, you know, this is something that we also need to get, you know, to impress upon people that, yeah, he was lied about.
Yeah, that's very, again, it's, people have such an aversion to figure, like, same with Hitler, because of all the, you know, the propaganda and the accounts, the news, the information they've been given about that. I mean, even with the war itself, I mean, Hitler has to be the devil incarnate because of the sacrifices and the moral compromises that were made to defeat him, to crush him. And so all the things that were done to win the war, the firebombing of German, the destruction of these beautiful German cities, the, you know, the deaths of millions of civilians, the raping of millions of German women, and these things, we have to cover these, you know, push them aside, because, well, all that's justified, not to worry about, because the Nazis were so evil. After all, they had those uniforms. So these sumptuous, you know, totalitarian looking uniforms, you know, these things. So it's one of these things, again, it's very hard for people to reconsider this. One thing is because their identity themselves, how they think of their country, particularly Americans, you know, you think of themselves as the, you know, sort of the nation, the liberator nation that went out and saved the world twice from Teutonic totalitarianism, you know, and saved the world from communism and these things. So they, Americans don't want to consider that fact that, that they have, you know, that the history they've been given and the role that their governments have played in some of these conflicts isn't quite as clean as been presented. I mean, you talk about, we talk about, you know, what the Germans are accused of doing. Now there are, I mean, obviously there was a world, you know, a general war for 6 years in Europe, a very destructive, violent war. The war in the East was terribly violent. They called it a cauldron. And there's a lot of violence, a lot of destruction. So you could probably pull from that a lot of atrocities on both sides.
For sure, on both sides. But I'll just interject there. So, sorry to interrupt. I'll just interject. But the rules of conduct for the German soldiers and for the German officers at these camps were so strict that Ursula Haverbeck, she talked about this, that at least two that we know of just at Auschwitz, at least two German officers were put to death by the Germans in their own, you know, rulings because they were mistreating prisoners. So they had very strict rules about how they were to conduct themselves both in the camps and as soldiers in the field. So the soldiers, the German army, I mean, it is renowned to have some of the highest code of conduct of any army in the world, and people who are in the know, they will verify that they know that the German army had very strict rules of conduct. And of course you're going to have people who break those rules, but the rules of conduct were such that if their own soldiers were to be caught doing such things as raping women in those places where they had occupied territory, they would be put to death by their own army. Now, the opposite is true for the Red Army, where they were encouraged to rape and loot and take, you know, break the pride of the German women. Who was that? Ilya Ehrenburg.
Yes.
Distributed leaflets upon his own, you know, ranks, the soldiers there to, well, you probably know this and maybe could recount it better than me, but basically it was just to, you know, kill a German. If you haven't killed one yet today, you know, kill one. And then if you've killed one, kill another, and just, you know, take the German women as yours, and on and on and on, just encouraging them with all this bad behavior. So that's the difference. So I agree with you. Atrocities surely were committed on all sides. But if one side has rules that tell them to be bad and the other side has rules that tell them to be good, that's the difference right there.
Yeah, it was, I think the Ilya Ehrenburg said 8 to 80 was the acceptable range for women.
Yeah. And they didn't even observe that. But
From what I understand, the German soldier comported himself very well by all standards, like the occupation of France. These things where they didn't come in, where the German army advanced, there wasn't mass raping or very little rape, from what I understand, reports that I hear of. It's all military operations. And the war, of course, the war in 1940 went very fast, a few weeks, and France abdicated or surrendered rather. And then they occupied, you know, the western part of France because England didn't sign the peace. So they had to occupy France. But there was reporting of collaboration. You know, of not collaboration, but fraternization.
Yes,
which you would expect to have with French and German, because ethically and culturally they're very similar. They're right, they're neighbors, and you're going to get along very well after many years, and that's really not surprising. But that's also an indication that the occupation was, I would say, relatively lenient if you didn't create problems. The Germans were the authorities then, because the government had surrendered. If you were engaged in partisan activity, you could counterinsurgency programs could be brutal. I understand that. And in those areas where there was more partisan activity, there were more much more brutal reprisals, like in the Balkans or in the Russian or in Russia. Sometimes there's also an issue of the other side committing what they call false flag, you know, barbarous things just for propaganda purposes. Think of the like the in Poland, where the assassination of the Polish officers, which are initially blamed on the Germans.
Oh, the Katyn Forest, are you talking about?
Yeah, the Katyn Forest.
That's just, it's such a horror what happened there, yeah. And that the Germans were blamed for it for 50 years.
Yes.
And until, I think it was until 89. And then they had to admit, oh, yeah, it wasn't the Germans, it was the Russians. But really, we mm-hmm. need to be clear, it wasn't the Russian people. No, it was the Bolshevik, the Jewish leadership.
Yeah, it was the NKVD at the time, I think.
Yeah.
Would have been the NKVD, which was the successor to the Cheka,
right.
Which was overwhelmingly Jewish, yes. The so in areas like in Czechoslovakia, I think the only time you had an act of German, I guess, barbarism, if you will, was after the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. And I think the city of Leidas, they went in, they shot all the men. But that was a British essay, I think a British intelligence operation, knowing it would cause a reprisal. They wanted to spark a reprisal,
mm-hmm.
you see. So they assassinated Reinhard Heydrich. And the Germans responded with a reprisal. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't have partisan activity, things were relatively stable. You didn't have constant brutality. You didn't get that with the Red Army. And again, there were no reports of mass raping on part of by German soldiers in any area where they occupied. And they occupied huge parts of Europe, of course, as we know. Just in those areas where there was partisan activity, you would expect to be much more violence.
Yeah.
Now, again, you can judge that morally for how you want, but the United States is not in the position to point fingers, because you look at kind of what the United States has done in the areas where its armed forces have occupied, whether it's recently in Iraq with a counterinsurgency doctrine, or the Phoenix program in Vietnam, or some of the dirty wars in South America. These things,
there's brutal behavior that is shameful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's documented. They did conduct themselves in a very shameful manner at times.
What they do with the Holocaust is they fuse it with this reporting of these Einsatzgruppen or police battalions on the Eastern Front. And this was an operation because the Germans were dealing with partisan activity, and they had advanced deep into Russia. So you had these operations being conducted behind the lines, often by Jews in Russia. And so the Einsatzgruppen was there to take care of this, to mop up. And I would understand in a cauldron like the Eastern Front, a lot of brutality, mm-hmm. hard to distinguish who's doing what to whom, and distinctions may not be made. But again, if you put it in context, it's understood. But that's not the Holocaust.
No. One of the most evil things that the Jews did is, and the Bolsheviks or the Red Army, they would wipe out a village, let's say, but leave a few survivors to tell the story, but they would dress up in German uniforms,
yes.
and pretend it was Germany that did this. And that's just so evil. It's such a deception. And then terrorize the people, torture them, kill them, but leave a few survivors, I say, but pretend it's somebody else that did it.
Or like something in the Ukraine, where the Germans came into the Ukraine in 1941, a lot of the Ukrainians were seeking retribution. So they greeted the Germans as liberators from the Bolsheviks.
Right.
And then they started meting out retribution to the people who had terrorized them for the better part of two decades. And we're seeing that sort of that ethnic or animosity in Ukraine today.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that you have the neocon, the Jewish neocon, supporting the Nazi Azov battalion against the Russians, right? Well, because they associate the Russians with the Bolsheviks, because there's a distinction between Bolsheviks and Russians. The Russians weren't the ones starving to death the Ukrainians in the 1930s. There was Kaganovich and the Jews working for Stalin. But the it's funny how that antagonism or the animosity is exploited for contemporary geopolitical reasons. So now you have Jews in the U.S. State Department agitating Nazis, Stefan Bandera, supporters. Well, by the way, Stefan Bandera was so insane, the Nazis put him in prison.
And that whole thing about them calling these people Nazis now, I'm very confused by all that. And
intentionally confused by it. That's the whole
thing. Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Because you're trying to, but the thing is, they're exploiting. So when you say something like the Azov Battalion, they're Nazis, okay? The Stefan Bandera and his, the reason why these people had these views towards the Bolsheviks and the Jews is because of what they had done to the Ukrainians in the 1930s. Then it's being exploited for modern, political reasons, for geopolitical reasons. Of course, obviously, the neocons in the State Department, have no desire to have Azov Battalion control Ukraine. They're just using him as a pawn in the game because they'll fight the Russians, and because they want to provoke this war between Ukraine and Russia, and also to draw Germany against Russia, which goes back to the whole reason why there was a First and Second World War to begin with, the Mackinder thesis. You keep Germany and Russia fighting rather than working together.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And we're doing that today now with I would have to say British or NATO, whatever, or maybe a contractor blew up that pipeline that fed natural gas to Germany.
Oh yeah, that was definitely a false flag, operation.
Yeah, but Germany under the Green Party is like cutting its throat economically to prolong this fight with Russia.
The Green Party in Germany is actually putting into place the Morgenthau Plan to deindustrialize Germany and turn it into.
Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about the Green Party. I would love to talk about the Green Party.
Well, you mentioned the Morgenthau Plan because what I understand is people are now talking about Germans themselves are talking about the Morgenthau Plan. First, what was the Morgenthau Plan and what's Morgenthau 2.0?
Yeah, okay. Well, there's so many plans to wipe out the Germans or to kill the Germans or to, end the Germans that, correct me if I'm mixing up the different plans. Like there were Kutenhof-Kalervi, I know that one is the race mixing plan. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Theodor Kaufmann, who just said Germany must perish, period. Like just sterilize all the men and voila, you got no more Germans within a generation. And then there was a guy named Pfizer. Like, isn't that funny? It's kind of like the current, jabbing pharmaceutical bioweapons production facility. But there was a Pfizer plan. And I don't remember now what that one was. But Morgenthau also had a plan to deindustrialize Germany and to reduce the landmass of Germany by half, I think, at the time. And basically, that would cause two-thirds of the German population to perish within short order.
Henry Morgenthau Jr. was the Secretary of Treasury for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I think 1934, 1945.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
It was his aide, Harry Dexter White, I think a half-Jew, also a communist agent, who wrote up the details of the plan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, so that's right. So this isn't just some lowly hick. This guy is really, really high up, but a lot of power. And Roosevelt said, yeah, good, let's do this. Like, and they're basically now resurrecting this plan. So when you say the Germans are talking about it now, are you saying that the Germans are aware of it and are rising up against it?
Or what it is that one thing, there was a couple of years ago when Germany had those floods in the Rhine Meadow area, there were reports of bodies coming to the surface. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but this started a conversation about the Rhine Meadow camps, General Eisenhower's Rhine Meadow camps, the camps where hundreds of thousands, maybe as much as a million. James Bakke wrote about it. I think he's a fellow Canadian, isn't he?
Well, yes, and he died a couple of years ago. Other losses.
Yes.
I'll never forget when the magazine, Saturday magazine, what it was called, Saturday Night or something, magazine published an article, I think it was 1989. That's in my book. I've written about it in my book. Saturday Evening Post, thank you. That wrote a big book review, and it was actually the cover page was a picture, I think, of the, these death camps. And I'm talking about these Rhine Meadow camps. I'm not talking about what most people think of death camps. When they hear death camp in Germany, they think of the, Auschwitz. No, we're talking about the camps where POWs, prisoners of war, were renamed disarmed enemy combatants so that they wouldn't have to follow any rules of, feeding them, for example, giving them enough food. My father was actually in one of those camps, and thank goodness he came out alive, because otherwise I wouldn't be here to talk to you right now. But I'll never forget when that came out, that article about it. And he was just agitated and relieved, but angry at the same time, and pacing around the house and just like holding this magazine, look, 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 finally, finally, somebody's talking about the other side. Somebody's talking about what, you know, was done to the Germans. And he was just, it was just unreal, actually, how strongly he reacted. And us kids, we were kind of ignorant about it all, but we were kind of wide-eyed watching my dad react to this article. But he was in one of those camps, so it was very natural that he had a very, very strong emotional reaction to this article. And like, finally, 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 somebody's telling another side of the story, you know. So that, yeah, that was quite an incredible moment, actually, in our household in Edmonton, Alberta.
Well, what it does is, again, we talked about projection, right?
Yes.
And these crimes, of course, Eisenhower later became U.S. president. Ike, everyone liked Ike, right? Very popular president in the 50s.
Yeah.
But he apparently had at least partially implemented the Morgenthau Plan with these camps where these POWs just to starve and to die, you know, from exposure, lack of
correct.
Water.
It was a deliberate policy to starve them, and nearby, you know, villagers, if they were trying to help these soldiers out by passing a loaf of bread or a crust of bread through the fence, they were ordered, the soldiers, the guards, they were ordered to shoot on sight any Germans who were going to help their countrymen, you know, across the fence. So it was a deliberate policy to kill as many Germans as possible. And you probably know this, but maybe some listeners don't know this, but more Germans died after World War II was over than during the war.
Yeah, 1945 to 1950, as many as 6 million. I don't want to throw that number out. But if you look at the dying in the camps, the starvation, also the displacement of ethnic Germans.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think it was more than 6 million, but whatever the numbers were, it was really, really high. Like, there was the largest expulsion of people in recorded history that we know of, was the ethnic Germans were expelled from their former, these were German territories. This was Germany, was much, much, much larger. People don't realize that, but also in these, just these ethnic area, German areas, they'd been there for hundreds of years. This is not just, you know, newly settled by Germans land. No, it was hundreds and hundreds of years of Germans were in these areas, and they were expelled, forcibly expelled. Something like, well, the estimates run between 16 and 20 million. And then in of those, 3 million or so died along the way. And, you know, many were shot or raped or, you know, starved or whatever. But 3 million died along the way. That's estimates of, you know, it could have been less, could have been more, but it's just huge. Think about that. That's a huge number of people. I mean, 16 million people being expelled from their homelands, have to leave everything behind, just take what they can fit on their back or maybe in a cart that they're pulling. And and then entering a country that's been absolutely flattened to the ground. That's the other thing. So, you know, it did cause a lot of stress and tension among the German people themselves, because here they're being pushed into land, a country that has been absolutely demolished by 6 years of war, bombing and firebombing of cities. So, you know, it's not just military targets and soldiers fighting each other. No, the cities got demolished, firebombed, and now all of a sudden the Germany, what's left of it, has to take in millions of their own kin and kith, you know, countrymen, refugees. And this was difficult. This was really hard times. It's no wonder that the diaspora is so huge. Like, Germans left Germany in great numbers after the war, like in the late 40s and throughout the 50s, my parents being among them. My parents left for different reasons. That's another story. But many, many, many Germans left Germany, scattered all over the world.
Yeah, this was the hunger year, 1946-47.
My mother talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
She said during the war, her family anyway, they never were hungry during the war, but after the war, they were literally so hungry they would faint while they were trying to put some seeds in the ground, thinking ahead, you know, trying to grow some food.
Yeah, the U.S. occupying authorities actually prevented any aid coming in.
Yes.
Yeah. That's something yeah,
there
Americans
was no
are not
reason.
Told
There was
about.
no reason. There was no reason for the people to starve other than by deliberate strategy. Germans were supposed to die. So the war was not over in 1945 for Germany. And I would say it's not over to this day.
Yeah, there were people who spoke up. I mean, Herbert Hoover, General Patton called it Semitic vengeance. He was disgusted by it. I mean, he was a proud soldier. You know, he thought he was fighting the good fight. Then he saw what happened afterwards. Of course, then he dies, conveniently dies in hospitals.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people die in hospitals.
Yeah, many people, like General Patton, you know, some minor injury, and then he dies in the hospital.
Yeah. And then, of course, you have that. Then, now you mentioned, you know, obviously, Germany goes through this destruction. And yeah, some of the destruction was necessary because in order to psychologically decapitate a people, you have to destroy their cities. You can't have a traditional cities like Dresden or Hamburg staying around and engage in a psychological war for a culture war against them, because these cities are rooted in their past. So you destroy these cities, are often as old as 1,000 years.
Yeah,
you know, and you firebomb on Dresden, you know, these things, completely unnecessary from a from
well,
a
this is totally
standpoint.
Evil. I mean, Dresden. Yeah. My mother always said, "Why Dresden? Why Dresden?" I mean, often I have memories of her just saying that, "Why Dresden?" And she just she never could come to terms with that, because she knew, and she told us kids, you know, she said Dresden was full of women and children and old, you know, men or old people and refugees, injured people. It was full. It was just,
well, yeah, you had people escaping the advancing Red Army, so the city had
exactly
been swollen.
And it was swollen, and people there, and it was the most beautiful city in all of Northern Europe, you could say, and in pretty much in all of Europe. It was just the most beautiful city. It's just an amazing, like every square inch on a building would be decoratively carved. I mean, it was just beautiful. And you know, I want to tell you something along those lines, like all these beautiful cities that were destroyed. Well, in communist East Germany, then I had the occasion to visit there in it's quite a few years ago now, maybe 15 years ago or so, and I saw some of these gray, drab, square concrete buildings that had been put up after the war. And this was not, you know, this was in communist East Germany. And these were apartment buildings or office buildings, whatever they were. They were just gray, drab, square buildings. Like, this was what communism, you know, that's communism. Make it ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Make it ugly. So you bomb and destroy the beauty, and then you make it ugly. It was so striking, I'm telling you. That must affect a people's psyche when they are born into that, they grow up in that ugliness. I mean, it must make a different person than a person who is growing up in surrounded by beauty.
Well, yeah, they call it brutalism, don't they? I think that's the
I don't know.
Brutalism,
that would
Bauhaus
be
Bauhaus architecture, this sort of this. Yeah, and we see that in the West too, right?
With
the,
yes.
The cult of ugly.
The cult of ugly, and that's Jewish. Yeah. And yes. People could look that up. I mean, you look at I did some research when I wrote an article about the, what did I call it? I can't remember now, but the uglification, I guess, of our art and culture and who's behind that. And 1963, the archives of the Congressional Record in the United States, Communist Party, their goals, and the Communist Party was largely Jewish, right? So these are Jewish goals. And Jewish people have said themselves that communism equals Judaism and Judaism equals communism. So anyway, these goals, part of them, some of them, it was to make art and music ugly. And we will put our people in the roles of critics. So in other words, they will basically tell people how to think about these things, you know.
So, yeah, you see it. And also with obscenity, where
yes,
like art, you know, obscene art, they'll say, well, it's art because the art critic says it's art.
And, yeah.
You know, the late person will go, well, it must be true because he's the expert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Canada, we had this thing that was in the art museum in Ottawa, like the Canadian Art Museum. I don't know what it's called, but the Voice of Fire. I don't know if you remember that. Are you from the States yourself?
Yes.
Okay. So in Canada, we had this thing get put into this, and it was bought for something like $1.5 million. And this is back in the I think the 1990s or 80s even, like it was that was a lot of money for the Canadian taxpayer to be paying, and people were outraged. But, you know, then there was big controversy about it, but they always kept telling us, oh, well, no, this is really brilliant art and you just don't understand it. You know, so the Jewish art critics are telling us that, well, if you don't appreciate this, it's just because you're kind of stupid, you know, like you just don't understand art. Well, if you have to, actually, Adolf Hitler has a beautiful quote, something about if the art needs to be explained to you, and if you need to read a whole essay to explain to you about some piece of art, well, then it's not art.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, that thing was purchased and bought. It was just three strips, vertical strips of, you know, blue, red, blue, or red, blue, red. I can't remember, but just this huge, huge thing that canvas that had these three colors that's it. There was nothing on it, but three vertical colors. And then I read an article years later that some guy saying, oh yeah, that would be worth much more now. Like, well, who's that guy telling us that? That's another Jew. Mm-hmm. Telling us, oh, it would be like, that was a good investment. It would be worth like 46 million now. Unbelievable. What they're making us crazy. Don't you think? I mean, that, yeah.
Well, that's what modern art. Again, I think Picasso was promoted by Jewish art traders.
Yeah.
Promoters. Yeah. You know, he was a competent artist, but he made his just doing this weird stuff, right?
Yeah. I would even argue about that. I think it's arguable whether he was a
good, but he wouldn't being a real artist, he never would have been famous, right?
Say again. I didn't
being,
catch that.
Being a real, I mean, producing real art, he never would have been famous.
Right.
People like Norman Rockwell, they hated him because he was what they call an illustrator. His was too normal.
Yeah. You can't have that. No, you can't have that.
But same with with Schoenberg and 12-step atonal music, right?
The music that drove me nuts. I mean, yeah. I've been a appreciator of music all my life, and attending concerts with my parents and classical music, you know, chamber music concerts and whatnot. And I always sort of dreaded that obligatory modern piece. And I always just thought, well, I guess maybe, you know, you grow to like it, but I never liked it. And now I understand it more, right? It was the imposition.
Well, he said it's there to drive you insane. Actually, he actually said that.
Who said that? Sorry.
I think Schoenberg said that.
Oh, well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think in, is it Bonn? Where is it? The Bach's hometown? Is it Bonn, Germany?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Actually,
the only Bonn. That city actually, I think, was mostly unscathed throughout the war. But the one building that was destroyed was Bach's home.
Oh, gee.
E. Michael Jones told me that. So there's,
oh, yeah. That? I didn't know that.
There's a hole in the ground. What's that? That was Bach's home. Why'd you dynamite it?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, boy. Oh.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to 90 minutes, I think.
Yeah,
not that I want to stop this conversation because it's very, very interesting, but I'm just kind of noticing.
No, that's fine. Now you your blog,
it's down right now, and I'm not sure if it's just a technical glitch.
Oh, really?
I've got my webmaster working on it, but that's the Free Speech Monica website. Then there's the Truth and Justice for Germans website. That's not down. That's up. So the Truth and Justice for Germans.com. That's all one word. And there's lots of good articles there that we, you know, republish other, mm-hmm. you know, good articles and whatnot. And there's also links to various things like videos and whatnot. So yeah, I'd encourage people to go there. And I mean, then the mission is really in the title there, Truth and Justice for Germans, really. So yeah, that, but my own website is down right now. I'm working on it, freespeechmonica.com. I don't know if it's an attack on me or if it's just a technical glitch, but I've got somebody working on it.
Okay. Well, so you're going to, what's going to happen with this law that you just passed up there?
I don't know. I take on Alfred's attitude, and these are just blots of toner on paper. And I have my God-given right to think clearly, think what I want to think, and speak words. I have that's my God-given right to do that. So I'm not too concerned. I don't even think about it. I don't lose sleep over it. It's you know, these guys are really in a panic. They're in panic mode to be passing these ridiculous laws, they call laws. You know, they really are in panic mode, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, it's a sign of desperation.
It is. It's a sign of desperation. They're at the end of their, they know that we are actually rising again. It might not look like that right now, but there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, the parasite is going to lose this, and we will persevere. We will rise again. We have done so in the past. It is bigger now because it's worldwide, but yeah, our spirit is you can't crush us. No way. So that's kind of the note that I'd like to finish on anyway.
Okay, that's good. Now, of course, you know, your Ernst Zundel, who was like you, he was a German who emigrated to Canada, and I think
I was born here, so that's a little bit different.
Okay,
he
emigrated, and he was an artist of some, I think, an artist of some sort, or
yes, he was a graphic designer. He was very, very talented, very good.
Yeah, and he was just doing that, and he just started like a little newsletter, and we'll finish up on this. And
yes,
he got into trouble, and he started being harassed. Now, he wasn't violating any laws. He was just an ethnic German Canadian citizen. He started a newsletter, pointing out some of the things we've talked about, of course.
Yes.
And that's when the trouble started. He was harassed. I think his house was burned down, assaulted. He then migrated to the United States, I think lived in Tennessee.
That's correct.
And somebody got him kicked out of the United States.
Yeah.
Sent back to
Canada.
Then Canada sends him to Germany.
Yes, that's right. And that was post 9/11. So there were different laws on the books that, and he couldn't face his accusers because they never even told him who his accusers were in Canada, which is completely unlawful when you think about it. You know, you should be able to know who your accuser is of what crime, but being post 9/11, all these new draconian.
He was tried in Germany for things he did in Canada. Right.
Yeah, I guess that's correct. Like,
okay, that's insane.
Absolutely, that's right. That's right. All his activism in terms of distributing newsletters and republishing that little booklet, "Did 6 Million Really Die?" That was all done in Canada.
And
that's correct.
Under the understanding, under the Charter of Rights, he thought it was his right as a Canadian citizen.
Of course,
right.
Of course. And you know, the irony of it all is he was a very he was a pacifist, like a strong pacifist. He was born in 1939, so he was a war baby, and then he came over to Canada. I think he was 19 years old, and wanted to go to a country where there was freedom. He wanted to go to a country where there's no draft, you know, military draft. Mm-hmm. He was a pacifist, an avowed pacifist, and then, you know, then he learns about the truth about his country, his people, and you know, National Socialist Germany and whatnot. And then he starts being an activist within he sends out a lot of newsletters. He did a lot of these radio programs, and he even ran for prime minister, actually. I don't know if you know that, but
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, he ran for leadership of the Liberal Party, and whoever won that became the prime minister. That's just how it works sometimes if there's a leadership race while that party has the majority in the House of Commons. And so he was running, I think he was running actually against Pierre Elliott Trudeau and numerous other candidates in that leadership race. And his big thing that when he was running was to defend the ethnic German immigrants, because he saw and experienced it himself that ethnic German immigrants were very poorly treated in Canada at the time. So, here's, you know, in the current day and age, and everybody's just calling the white people all racists and evil. And you think, right, even back to then, how the Germans were being mistreated. And I've heard this from many German people who came over, and my parents, well, to a lesser extent, I guess, experienced that, because my dad had to redo all his medical schooling here because his medical degree from Germany was not acknowledged and not accepted. So that was a form of discrimination. But after that, I didn't really catch wind of my parents getting discriminated against. But that was pretty major discrimination, I would say. But anyway, lots of German people got really discriminated against in Canada in the 1950s, you know, or 60s, because they did the Holocaust, right, supposedly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that... Anyway, yeah, I was talking about Ernst Sandl, and that's an anecdote that's not that many people know, that he actually was running and would have become prime minister had he won that. Of course, he, you know, didn't come anywhere near winning that.
He died in prison in Germany, didn't he?
No. So, after he had his, fast forward, so Tennessee, and then he was picked up there under the collusion of three governments, Germany, Canada, United States, picked him up on a minor thing and basically kidnapped him from his property there and sent him to Canada, where he spent 2 years in solitary confinement, being tortured, you know, 24/7 lights on, mm-hmm. and it was cold and whatnot. Like, it was, that's torture. Solitary confinement, that's torture. Anyway, then he was extradited to Germany. And there he went through a trial. Then he was given the maximum penalty there, 5 years prison for words again. And he got out, and then he lived for another few years, and he lived in his ancestral home in the Black Forest in Germany.
Okay.
And he was spent those last years fixing up the ancestral home and that kind of thing. So he went quiet. He had done his battle. He paid his dues. He had done so much that it's very, very understandable that as far as being active on this topic that we talked about today, no, he basically rested. He was in resting mode at that point. But, you know, he couldn't even get together with his wife, Ingrid Rimland-Zandl, unless they met in Mexico, and they did so on numerous occasions. They would both fly to Mexico to be together for a few weeks, and then they had to each go back to their respective countries, she in the United States and he in Germany, and they neither of them could go to each other's home because they would immediately be thrown in jail.
All for producing newsletters and doing some radio appearances.
An avowed pacifist for words, but this is the most dangerous kind of criminal in the eyes of those who are running the, you know, calling the shots, those who are themselves the criminals, right? So mm-hmm. everything being inverted. Yeah, those who are telling the truth, using words, you know, that's really dangerous in their view. So, yeah, they have to be treated particularly harshly.
Hate speech.
What a concept.
What a concept. So, well, Monica, thank you for spending so much time with me tonight.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation with you. It's been really, really enlightening that you've shared some really great stuff. Thank you for that. I think everybody needs to know that history, and you're very sharp on that history.
Well, you're certainly welcome. So, hey, enjoy the snow.
Yeah, thank you.
So, and the calm that comes with the snow, and
yes,
and hope everything goes well for you. Hope they don't bother you with this new law. So,
oh, no, thank you very much. Okay,
take care then.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye.